The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
You do some reflection on questions, and I thought I'd say a few words about that process and how it's supported me in my practice. And then I thought I'd see what some of your questions were. So a couple of times I found this. The first time I really found this reflection interesting was, it was kind of, I wasn't trying to do it, but I was on a retreat. It was my first 2-week retreat, and every morning in the instruction sitting, there was an opportunity for asking questions. And I had this feeling that doubt was up in my practice. I felt like I didn't understand things. There was just a lot of doubt, and so I was trying to frame the question for the morning, for the Q&A period in the morning. And while I was doing that, I was listening to how my mind was talking about the question. And I discovered that every sentence, as I tried to frame the question in my mind, as I tried to articulate the question in my mind, the first two words of every one of the questions was, "I'm afraid." And after hearing that several times, multiple times, hearing myself frame the question about doubt, begin with, "I'm afraid that, I'm afraid that, I'm afraid that," I thought, is this fear? Maybe this is about fear. And I didn't get much further than that, because the question period started, and I didn't actually get to ask my question. But that process of kind of clarifying, it was a little bit of clarification. In retrospect, I see there was a little bit of a clarification around the question, that probably the feeling of doubt was somewhat connected to a feeling of fear. And so I kind of carried that away with me that morning and just was continuing to observe my experience. And I saw fear everywhere. I hadn't known that there was quite a bit of fear present for me on that retreat. And as I had framed that question and saw that fear was kind of in the mix of the question about doubt, it oriented my attention, it oriented my mindfulness to begin recognizing the doubt, that fear was actually all over the place. You know, I'd walk down a hallway and someone would turn into the hallway and appear there, and whew, there'd be a flash of fear. Just a lot of places. Just subtle fears, bigger fears. So it was very helpful for me to have spent some time trying to reflect on what my question was. And in that process of reflecting, it got refined a little bit. It actually shifted the question to reflect on the question. And then it was actually helpful. Never having even been able to ask the question, it was helpful in my practice. It opened up a doorway into a whole new seeing of things I hadn't seen before. So that's one example. That one operated pretty quickly in my practice. Another example was at the end of a retreat about 18 months ago. I was sitting with one of my Burmese teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to see him for a long time. In fact, I'm going to see him this May, so it will have been 2 years. So I knew it was going to be a year or two before I saw my teacher again. And so I had some thoughts, I had some questions about my practice, but I hadn't quite figured out how to articulate it clearly. And so in the last couple days of the retreat, I took some time each day to reflect on what is the question? What is the question that I want to ask my teacher? And this process of reflecting on the question, what is it that I want some support about? What is it that I'd like him to offer some reflections on around my practice? It helped me to refine, to think about exactly what was the kind of crux of the question. And in that exploration, in that very exploration of what is the question, and I had only probably 10 minutes with him that I would get an opportunity to ask this question. But the process of refining the question actually went through several layers, and that exploration actually took me through some recognition of, oh, well, that part, I understand that part of the question. I don't need to ask him about that part. Or I see this is the place to explore here for this part of the question. Or, oh, I understand, I can look at this more clearly. So the very exploration of the question helped my mind to understand what I, the direction I needed to go in my practice, even before I had the opportunity to ask him the question. So the very posing that, what is it that I would like to ask my teacher, began to tap into some of the wisdom that was present in me. And that was a really beautiful thing to see. Sometimes our questions, if we take the time to reflect on our questions, we find there's a lot more wisdom inside of us than we realize. So it can be actually a part of our practice to explore and to refine our questions. So I thought I'd see what some of your questions were and maybe offer some comments if there's anything I could comment on. But what were some of your questions? And also you can recognize or think about the offering of a question into the room is, it's like a gift to the room because partly because it is sometimes a scary thing to offer a question, and partly because sometimes the way somebody frames a question and then it gets responded to, it meets so many things that other people are experiencing, and so it's a gift to share with the room.
So my question has to do with intuition, and
okay, can you hear me? Okay,
yeah.
Okay,
hold it close.
Okay,
there you go.
Is that better? Okay. My question has to do with intuition, and kind of a two-part question. Like, what does Buddhism have to say about intuition as a concept? And then, how do you tell the difference between intuition and fear?
Oh, that's interesting. And so I want to ask you some questions in return. What do you mean by intuition?
I mean sort of like inner wisdom, as we all, like how you were saying, sometimes if you reflect a little bit, you surprise yourself with what you know.
Yes.
So that's sort of my idea of intuition, is sort of that gut feeling and sort of an internal compass and internal wisdom.
Okay. And in your framing of the question between intuition and fear, is there a kind of an understanding or, let's say, intuition of how they're linked for you?
For me, like, I guess I'm more relating it to decision-making in my life, and sometimes I want to do something, but I can't distinguish between whether it's fear or whether it's intuition, like, warning me maybe that's not a good idea, because I do have doubt and fear, you know, come up in my life and in terms of decision-making. So that's
more
the context of
it. I see. Okay, so when you're thinking about making a decision, or looking at your intuition, sometimes it sounds like your intuition, I'm wondering if your intuition tends to primarily express itself in that way of be careful. So that's an interesting thing to recognize about your own experience of intuition, that kind of it may frame itself that way. So the first thing first of all, before I go there, I want to see, does anybody else have any questions that seem somewhat similar to this? If there's anybody that had a kind of a question around fear or intuition or inner wisdom that seems kind of similar, I could put that into the mix as I explore thoughts about it. Yeah, okay.
So when you were talking, is this working?
I think so,
yeah?
Yes.
Okay. I was actually going to go somewhere else, and I think it's sort of related, maybe it's the opposite, where I was wondering, how can you tell the difference between intuition and clinging? Meaning, if you think your intuition's, that's, you think something is good, but how do you know it's not because you're really wanting something?
Yes. Okay, so that's good to bring in the other side of it, because sometimes people have the intuition of, oh, I should do that, as opposed to be careful. It's, oh, the intuition says, yes, do that, and how do we distinguish between the kind of sense of the intuition telling us because we want it. Exactly. Okay. Great. Thanks for including that. Any other thoughts in the room around this question? Yeah.
I guess I'd like some of the framing to be in reference to not self or anatta. I wasn't specifically thinking about fear or intuition, but my question more had to do with, I've been looking at cultivating compassion and looking at when I feel compassionate and I don't, and I feel like there's a strong sense of self or unskillful sense of self within that, times when I'm not feeling compassionate or the opposite of compassion. So I guess I'm looking at a way to cultivate not self or skillfully use that as a support to my practice.
Okay. Okay, I think I can include something about that. So I'll say a few words about this theme, and then we'll see if there's other questions to explore. The kind of sense of intuition as a concept. The word intuition, as far as I know, isn't really used in the Buddhist texts. And yet, I do see that the more we practice, it does, that the more clear our minds get. So I think this question is going to be more from experience rather than from, like, what the two to say about intuition. So the more we can come into the present moment, meet experience in the present moment, the more our ideas, our concepts kind of get out of the way. I mean, we live so much of our lives through our thoughts, through our concepts of the world, and not actually as much through meeting the world directly. And I think that living the world through concepts, what we think about it, what we fear about it, what we want about it, as we live our lives through concept, we're actually obscuring that inner wisdom, that what I like that definition of intuition, that sense of knowing what's skillful, what's helpful for us. That's maybe one way to frame what that inner wisdom is from a Buddhist perspective, is around understanding what helps us to move towards happiness and what helps us to move away from struggle, from suffering. So the kind of qualities of mind of aversion, of anger, of confusion, of wanting, of pride, all of those kind of emotional terrain related to greed, related to aversion, related to delusion, those tend to take us and wind us back into a place of struggle and suffering. And so the inner wisdom that we're exploring and cultivating in this practice is about what helps us to become more truly happy. Not happy in the way that our culture tells us that we should be happy. Buy more, have things, have status, you know, the kind of that way of acquiring things that the world tells us that that's where happiness comes. But there's a kind of a reframing of where happiness comes from. The Buddha, in his own understanding and awakening, recognized it's not so much about what we have, it's about aligning ourselves with truth, where happiness comes from, aligning ourselves with reality, what's actually happening in experience. I mean, something could be happening in our experience. We could be caught in the midst of a very difficult situation. You know, we've had we're driving our car and we get in a car accident, and you know, all of the amount of wishing it hadn't happened, which we might bring to that situation, doesn't make it not so. So the, you know, aligning ourselves with the truth of it's like this right now. How can I meet this in a way that is skillful? So this is the inner wisdom that we begin to touch into through our exploration of our experience moment after moment. We meet our experience and begin to see where we hold on, where we cling, where we don't like things, where we want to get rid of things. So our minds begin to see those patterns of clinging and aversion as not so helpful. And some of the thoughts, the ideas, the opinions that we kind of relate to the world through, we begin to see also how those are often not so helpful either, that they often get in the way or are obscuring what's actually here. So we may, for instance, have an opinion about a person we're working with. And, well, you know, it can be helpful to have a sense of who people are. There's a kind of, and this is perhaps a little bit of where intuition comes in. You know, what part of our thoughts, ideas, opinions are helpful to hold lightly, to, and what part is like just completely extra and completely extraneous? So, you know, and this I think does touch into that kind of sense of the gut feeling in a way. You know, there's sometimes when I meet people, I have a kind of a sense of, you know, something I don't quite understand, but I've got a sense of them, you know. And some of that may be telling me, oh, be careful around this person, or some of it may be telling me this person is trustable or something, you know. So we might have that kind of sense of the person. So if we can see that we're not meeting that person through our ideas about them, then we have a little bit more sense perhaps that maybe we're meeting kind of more directly the experience of the person. Some subtle indications. I mean, as we more clearly meet our experience with mindfulness, the more we can actually be with the sights, the sounds, the smells, the physical experiences of our body, the thoughts that are arising in the moment, the more we're clear about those, the more we know what's coming in, the more we're aware of what's coming in, the more we can begin to understand or see, oh, you know, the response that I'm experiencing here has to do with the expression on the person's face. You know, that so maybe we begin to be able to recognize where some of our feelings are arising from, where some of those gut feelings are coming from, because we're much more clear about what we're actually seeing. So that begins to help us to see a little bit about where those intuitions arise from. And I think that's helpful for us. To begin to recognize that. So, you know, we might see, for instance, that our opinion about somebody is being created, or our feeling about somebody is being created based on an expression on their face, as opposed to you know, just taking that gut feeling. It might be that we can see, oh, actually, you know, maybe that person is grimacing because they've got a toothache, or, you know, so we begin to understand where some of our views and opinions come from. So in terms of distinguishing either our intuition, that inner wisdom, either from a sense of be careful or, ooh, you know, wanting that, I think some of it comes from the clarity that begins to happen as we more directly meet what the experience is. So we, like that example of somebody, the grimace on somebody's face, you know, when we begin to see where some of those intuitions arise from, we can begin to recognize, well, actually, some of that may be related to fear, or some of that may be related to clinging. So the kind of the refinement of our awareness begins to both refine our understanding of what is coming in and where our intuitions are born from, but also I think this refinement of this understanding, or the refinement of our knowing what's happening for us, also begins to really, it's not only we get more sensitive to what's happening in the world. So yes, we get much more sensitive about knowing what we're actually taking in and where those intuitions arise from. But we also get more sensitive to the the inner responses and reactions. We get more sensitive to seeing how the contraction of fear, or the holding of clinging, how that actually feels. We get much more familiar with knowing when fear is present and when clinging is present. We begin to really get so familiar with that it is much easier then to distinguish wisdom from clinging or fear. So there's something more I want to say about that. Partly, I think the whole process is a refinement. You know, we may not initially be able to make these distinctions, you know, that we recognize, okay, so there's this sense, be careful here. Okay. Be aware of that. Know what the experiences, know what is what you're responding to, and know that that's the inner feeling. Okay, there's a feeling, be careful. In that moment, that may be all the information that you have accessible to your mindfulness, but that is where you start. We start with the feelings and the experiences that we have, what we know. And so not to try to second guess it or to figure it out in that moment necessarily. It's like, okay, this is my immediate response. That's what's happening. Now, you may be able to, in that moment, sometimes in the midst of daily life, those kinds of reactions, you may just want to take that in and say, okay, yep, that feeling, beware, that's happened. Let me follow through on that. I'll watch that this time and follow through on that. And just keep watching. Just keep watching and exploring what your experience is moment after moment. Over time, the more we practice, the more we get familiar with our fears and our anxieties, our clingings, the more we begin to be able to kind of tease apart what's an inner response of reactivity and what's kind of more maybe an intuitive response that's coming out of wisdom. So I guess patience is one of the things to bring in here, there's no cut and dried rule of how to distinguish these things. But I do see in my own practice that the more I come into the world of direct experience, the more I trust that my response is not coming out of reactivity, but more out of wisdom. And that's a slow process to find our way to that more continuous mindfulness. I think one of the things that I would say about this, when is intuition true wisdom and when is it fear or clinging? If there's been a lot of thinking going on in the mind, there's a good chance that there's not a lot of wisdom that's directly present. So just know that. For me, at least, the kind of wisdom that that begins to be revealed in our practice is wisdom and intuition that is revealed in our practice is wisdom that arises from being present, from being here. So that's the kind of wisdom that we can begin to distinguish, intuition we can begin to distinguish from clinging and from fear, because clinging and fear will be experienced in that place as a kind of contraction. And there can be just a recognition of seeing, oh yes, this is clinging, this is fear, because the mind is more fully present with what's happening. Now, in terms of including reflections on self and not self, kind of woven through this in a way has been indirectly the more the mind is present in a place of wisdom, the more the mind is able to meet experience and know experience is happening in the moment, the less the sense of self comes into play. Fear and clinging actually arise from a sense of a me, an I, that feels like it needs to be protected or to be shored up. So the kind of intuition or inner wisdom that gets strengthened is not related to I or me. That's another kind of clue, perhaps, around the intuition related to the practice that we're talking about. When we when we have the sense of when we have the sense of intuition about what's happening in the moment, when we have a sense of presence without a sense of I or me or mine, that very place right there, the mind tends to respond wisely to the world when we're not trying to defend ourselves and when we're not trying to gather things or keep things or hold things for ourselves. So it's kind of a spiral into that place of intuition and wisdom in the practice. We can't just start there. That's one teaching that the Buddha offers is relying on this, abandon that. So, you know, the idea of just saying to yourself, oh, well, the Buddha teaches that there's no self here to defend or protect, so I don't need to be afraid. Well, good luck with that. You know, that doesn't, our bodies and minds don't work that way. So there's kind of a staged approach. We start by, the practice asks us to start where we are, just acknowledging right here what is happening. And so if there's a sense of a clenching in the gut that says, be careful, that's worth paying attention to in this moment. Whether it is in that moment understood as being fear that's arising or intuition that's arising, initially it's not so much that we have to know that in that moment. What we are asked to do is to see, recognize, what is it that we are experiencing in this moment? There's that clenching in the gut. There's a feeling of contraction in the throat. There's a sense of fear in the mind, and there's all kinds of thoughts going on. That person's not safe. I need to be careful about that person. And that person did that thing to me 20 years ago. So the mind kind of doing its thing. So that's what's happening in the present moment. That's what we're asked to meet. And there's all kinds of strategies for beginning to be able to meet what is happening in the present moment, and mindfulness is one of them. If we can actually meet our experience with mindfulness, that's a great way to go, because we learn so much about just this very question of what is trustable in our minds. I think that's kind of what it comes down to, this question around intuition, is what's trustable? What do we trust? And initially, you know, we start to see a lot of when we're first starting our practice is that, well, there's an awful lot of stuff going on in our minds that is not necessarily terribly trustable. You know, it's telling me, I need to have this, I need to have that, I need to have that. You're not going to be happy unless you have that. You know, you need to get this, you need to get rid of that. And boy, that was sure my mind, you know, before I met the practice. My orientation was, got to get rid of things. Anything unpleasant in the environment, find it, search it out, get rid of it. That'll make you happy. Well, what that was, what ended up doing is creating a pattern around search and destroy, you know, that you know, if there wasn't anything in particular that was unpleasant, then the mind would create something that was unpleasant so that it could be gotten rid of. So, you know, that pattern of how our minds do things, we begin to see through this exploration, through meeting our experience, oh, that pattern of search and destroy isn't very helpful. It's not very trustable. So it begins to reveal itself over time, what is more trustable. The other side of it is clinging, you know, wanting to have something. That's another kind of very common pattern, that something pleasant out there, I want it. I want more of it. Having that is what's going to make me happy. And then, you know, we get that, we get some happiness, that feels good, but, you know, the reality is it doesn't last for long, so the pattern about happiness is created that got to find another thing to get, to have, to be happy. And again, so it's instead of search and destroy, it's search and attain is the pattern. Find and get, find and get, find and get. And that find and get, have and attain pattern has its downfalls just as the search and destroy pattern has, because the things that we get naturally are not permanent, so they fall away. They disappear. And we find ourselves in a position of wanting to have, you know, the next thing. So we find ourselves, what is it that I can want so that I can get it, so that I can be happy? So it becomes a searching pattern. So we begin to see these things are not so trustable, that the way we think that we will find happiness, the way we think we'll find happiness, we've got it kind of backwards, actually. And so this begins to be shown to us in our practice, that these habits of wanting, 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 aversion, 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 are not so trustable in terms of finding our way to happiness. That gets revealed kind of slowly over time. You know, we look at a pattern of clinging or of fear over and over again, and we begin to understand it more deeply. We begin to understand that pattern of fear, that pattern of wanting. And in that understanding, we begin to be able to recognize it as a process. So it begins to be clearer to us. And we begin to also see that the tools that we're using to understand our minds, these tools that we're using to understand our minds, mindfulness and concentration and effort and patience and determination and kindness, all of these tools that help us to meet our experience, these things, while you know, they don't directly give us anything, they offer us a kind of a, This is where we begin to see these things are a little more reliable in terms of helping us to find our way to happiness than those patterns of search and destroy or have and attain. So we begin to recognize that relying on mindfulness, relying on concentration, relying on patience and kindness, those support us to move towards being able to be here, meet our experience in this moment. And that begins to show us. We begin to see that actually is productive of a different kind of happiness, a different way of being happy. So the wisdom is incremental. We learn slowly over time. We learn what we can let go of, how to meet our experience, and what supports us in moving towards happiness. I don't know if I hit all of the points in there, but is there anything that's come up in that? Yeah.
So I'm realizing as you're talking that sort of the more important something is to me and the more adamant I can get about it, then the harder it is really to bring the wisdom in. So, you know, I'm thinking of an example about, you know, my husband and I talk about, do we need to move? And it's like I have no wisdom on that whatsoever, you know, because it's a big one and it's very important. And
it can be really helpful to begin to tap into this more intuitive kind of wisdom to see, okay, yep, mind is kind of going crazy around this. And might there be a way to kind of, you know, sometimes with big decisions like that, it can be an interesting thing to explore. Okay, mind goes nuts along around that. So let me see. So here we come back to questions again. Can I frame a question for myself? So refine a question. What is a question that I want to start with there? So start with that reflection. You know, what is the question I actually want to ask myself? Is it as big as do I want to move or not? Or is it a little more refined than that? So refine a question, and then when you have a question, so take some time to think about what is the question I really want to explore here, and then bring it into a meditative setting. So let yourself sit 5-10 minutes, just allowing yourself to breathe, hang out, come into the present moment, give yourself an opportunity to be here, and maybe even 5 or 10 minutes of being here with the breath opens the mind to a little bit of a place of wisdom. So after 5 or 10 minutes of just hanging out, drop the question into the meditation. And then don't try to figure it out, but see what kind of intuitive responses begin to bubble up. And, you know, just allow them to bubble up, and then don't chain off of those things that bubble. It's like, okay, that's, you can kind of take note of them in your mind. Okay, that's bubbled up, that's bubbled up, that's bubbled up. Let that go on for 5-7 minutes, and then take some notes. What bubbled up around that question? And do that several times, you know, maybe over the course of a week, once a day over the course of a week, and the question may get refined over the week, so you could drop in different questions at different times. But then at the end of the week, look through your notes and allow yourself to kind of, again, be in a meditative space, and then look through your notes and allow yourself to kind of let your non-thinking mind meet those questions. How does it feel? Or meet those thoughts, those things that bubbled up. How do they feel? How does it feel as you reflect on that? How does it feel as you reflect on that? Because there's a lot of inner wisdom, intuition, that comes in our feeling responses. And what often happens with those feeling responses is it very quickly goes to thoughts. And so at least you'll be able to get a little bit of a sense of what the actual feelings are around these various decisions. There may be fear, there may be anxiety, there may be excitement, there may be confusion. You know, so you get a little bit of what the terrain is around those questions. Now, what I'm suggesting here may or may not give you a clear, cut-and-dried answer. But it will open you to a place where you've got more opportunity for a little bit of wisdom to begin to inform the decision. So it can be helpful to do that. And, you know, so if there is something where there's like a lot of thoughts going on, find a question, refine a question, and then reflect on that question in a meditative way. See how that goes for you. So I want to say a little bit more about reflecting on the question in a meditative way. So when you drop the question in to the meditation, so thoughts might bubble up, or feelings might bubble up, or body sensations might happen. All of those things are worth noting. And then, you know, just kind of allow them. Whatever comes is fine. Nothing is out of the range of what is okay there. It's information. You know, it's like it's allowing information to be recognized around this question. It's a different kind of information than the information you get from thinking about it. So it's opening more channels for information. Body, emotions, thoughts, all of them can be available. So drop in the question and then just kind of what's here? And just keep coming back to the question, you know, just as much as you can. You know, drop in the question and what's here now? Okay. And take a breath. And then drop the question again, and what's here now? So just to explore, it's not only about what kind of thoughts bubble up, but what kind of feelings and body sensations bubble up too.
Thank you. And sometimes having asked a question, the answer comes not in that particular meditation, but something.
But later, yes. Yeah. Actually, yeah. Yes. I mean, the work of framing a question is helpful. And then, yeah, I mean, it might happen when you're driving down the freeway. It's like, oh, yeah, sometimes that just having the question there can open you to seeing different avenues for information to present itself. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Those of you who asked the question, is there anything more you want to come back to in what I said? Yeah.
I want to know, why does the mind obfuscate so much? I mean, it seems like it's an enemy. The mind just... Why is that?
Why does the mind obfuscate so much? This is a great question, and I could probably talk for a long time on this one. See what I can say in 5 minutes. I guess primarily, what's going on in our minds is that we're trying to be happy. I mean, basically, I think as human beings, that's what we want. We want to be happy. We want to feel good. We don't want to have unpleasant experience. We want to have pleasant experience. So, you know, at kind of a basic level, we're kind of like a pleasure-seeking machine in a way. And the challenges or the difficulty is that without given a full set of information, without given full, complete understanding and knowledge of how the mind and body works, which we don't come born with. Our minds basically opt for the shortest way to happiness. It opts for the most obvious way to feeling good, which generally means having this thing or getting rid of that thing. Kind of the most immediate kind of gratification in a way. That's kind of like when we're babies, that's kind of the program that's running, you know. Get food, cry when you are hungry, you know. it's kind of like that kind of sense of gratifying the body. And we learn through a lot of experience as we're growing up that having what we want makes us feel good, getting rid of what we don't want makes us feel good. So we that program gets kind of re-cemented. It gets a groove gets built around that program, such that essentially the mind starts to believe that the only way to be happy is either to have what we want or to get rid of what we don't want. And that's confusion in the mind. I mean, that it's essentially pretty short-sighted. But without actually turning towards our experience and beginning to understand and recognize, you know, the very wanting itself. So just in this example of wanting something pleasant, in that very experience of wanting something pleasant, the wanting is telling you, the wanting program is telling you, I need to have that thing. Happiness will come when you have that thing. That's what wanting tells us. Wanting is not going to tell you that ease of mind will come when the wanting goes away. Wanting is deluded about itself. You know, wanting doesn't understand that the problem actually is in the wanting itself, not in the not having of the thing. So there's inherently some delusion operating in the very patterns of how we have conditioned ourselves to be happy. And without actually turning and looking at what does it feel like to be a human being that wants, which is not an obvious question. You know, it's actually pretty brilliant that the Buddha decided to look at this, you know. What does it feel like to want? You know, rather than taking for granted that having the thing that wanting desires is the way to happiness, the Buddha said, well, let's look at this wanting. And lo and behold, when you look at wanting, when you turn towards wanting, the information is right there. Wanting does not feel good. Immediately you see that right in the very process of trying to get what you want, there is suffering happening. And that information is life-changing. It alters the patterns of the mind as we begin to see that the way that we thought we would find happiness inherently contains suffering in it. That information begins to set the processes into motion for the mind to begin to understand that happiness can come in a different way. So the obfuscation is not I was going to say it's not intentional, but it's just a function of not having complete information about what's happening in our experience. As soon as we turn towards what's happening in our mind and bodies, the mind begins to absorb that information and take it in and use it in its choices to what will make this mind and body more reliably happy. It begins to take that information in and begins to recognize, well, you know, continually having what I want actually doesn't get me very far, and maybe there's another way. Maybe just letting go of the wanting, or maybe watching the wanting. If you watch wanting and see it disappear, you will see the ease and release that comes from being removed from that vice grip of delusion that I need to be satisfied. It's quite a mind-changing witnessing to see what it feels like when wanting lets go, when wanting has not had its desire satisfied. You see, when the wanting lets go, there's no problem. You don't have to have the thing in order to feel okay. But that information is not obvious. I mean, it is not just it takes some of the inner work to begin to really see that. And there are many, many layers of that kind of holding that happen in our mind stream. So we may begin to see, you know, that we can let go of kind of the more obvious ways that we get ourselves caught. And then we begin to see their subtler ways, and even subtler, and even subtler, and even subtler. And each level, there's a deeper recognition of the ways the mind doesn't understand how it's getting itself into trouble. So it's a great question. I could talk for a long time on that, but it's time to stop. So thank you for your participation this evening.